Welcome into the Future Sox Roundup. My name is Elijah Evans. I am joined, as always, by my co-host, Jeff Cohen. And today we have a very special guest, Birmingham Barons broadcaster, Kurt Bloom. We are super excited to have Kurt on with us and talk about recent stuff with the White Sox, Dylan Cease trade a few days ago. Garrett Crochet was named earlier today as the opening day starter, which is pretty remarkable considering he's never started a major league game. And then we're going to dive into everything related to Kurt's daily life, watching the Birmingham Barons, players that he saw last season that we are kind of expecting to see in Chicago this year, in addition to just everything else he does on a daily basis with the Barons, being around a lot of these minor league guys. You know, we love our prospects at Future Sox, so we are very excited. So welcome in, Kurt. First of all, how you doing? Good to have you.
Great. Thank you. Outstanding. Ready to go. Batteries are recharged. And it's time to plug in and go.
Yeah, it's we're about 2 weeks away from less than 2 weeks away from Major League Baseball opening day. And then before you know, the minor league season gets going. So let's start here with the Dylan Cease trade. So for those listening, you know, Ian and James did a great job breaking it down earlier this past week. But, you know, Dylan Cease was finally moved. This was kind of just a when, not an if, unfortunately. It's kind of what it came down to this offseason. It became evident that he was going to get traded. But now he ends up going to the San Diego Padres, who swept in and were able to bring him in to San Diego to kind of fill their rotation. In exchange for three prospects and relief pitcher Steven Wilson. The prospects, Drew Thorpe, Jairo Iriarte, and Samuel Zavala. Very interesting guys, headlined by two pitchers and then a really young outfielder who was impressive last year at single-A ball. Drew Thorpe is a guy that we'll start with Thorpe. I want to get your take on this, Jeff, and if you've looked into it at all, Kurt, as well. But Drew Thorpe's a guy who I think many expect to be in Chicago pretty soon. I don't think he breaks camp, but, you know, last year in Double-A, at your level of ball, Kurt, the guy had a 1.48 ERA in his five starts in Double-A and has already shown to be, you know, a lot of upside in a well-rounded game. He throws five pitches. He's just got a lot to like about him. So what have either of you seen from what you've read about Thorpe and just what you're looking forward to seeing from him?
Kurt, go ahead.
Well, he starts off with a changeup, which is supposed to be a plus-plus pitch from him. And being a right-handed pitcher, that's a major, major weapon that you can use on lefties because you're going to get a lefties coming off the bench. And I think for White Sox fans, this is not Dylan Cease or Michael Kopech mid-upper 90s. This is mid-lower 90s. But I'm an old school broadcaster. I came from the old school White Sox, and all of our teachers years ago, it was all about command and control and things along those lines versus high octane velocity, trying to get a high swinging strike. So he kind of, from reading about it, he kind of sets us back a good 10 years in terms of his stuff, which is great. I'm very much, if anybody can get me in and out less than 3 hours, that becomes my friend. That guy is my friend immediately.
Yeah, I love that. That's true. Thorpe's definitely an old school style pitcher, and he's going to get you with the secondaries more than he's going to get you with the fastball. The fastball he almost uses as a pitch just to locate and to get you off of his off speed to then go back to that changeup and his two slider variations. You don't see a ton of guys these days who are really effective with both a sweeper style and a sharp slider style. So that's one thing I watched a little bit of Thorpe film this past week, and it's interesting to see how those play off each other, because the changeup is his bread and butter, probably the best changeup in the entire minor leagues, like you mentioned. But then him having kind of two different versions of a sweeper and a slider that both have some different tendencies to them, and he's able to use them in different situations and different counts, is really fun to watch, and just someone that I think is going to be, you know, an exciting piece. Jeff, what was your thoughts from what you've seen from Thorpe?
Well, I want to double back just to the trade in general. I thought the timing was great. Cease had a great spring. I think his value wasn't going to get much higher. And teams like the Yankees, Padres, some of these guys were desperate. I thought the timing was good. And the return looks pretty exciting right now.
Yeah, I completely agree. And then Jairo Iriarte is a guy that I think is you're going to see a lot of Iriarte. I think he's going to spend probably most of the season in Double-A this year because the stuff is there. He has the stuff to be a Double-A pitcher already. He was really good in High-A last year, made his way up to Double-A, struggled a little bit with the command. But I think being in Birmingham is the perfect place for him to just really hone his command. And we saw that with a guy like Nastrini last year who came into the organization with a ton of stuff and in Birmingham was working on refining it and finding the control and finding how to use his pitches to the best of his abilities. So what do you think from Iriarte and what do you think he can kind of learn being in probably starting in Birmingham? I think that's the expectation for him.
Well, Jeff and Elijah, we're going to have, the Barons are going to have a brand new pitching coach in John. And Eli was a Birmingham Baron not too long ago. And I think that's an advantage of how he can relate. He pitched on that very mound. And it's interesting that the thing, as soon as I heard about Drew Thorpe, the first thing I thought of was John Eli, because I've been broadcasting Barons baseball for now 32 years. And Eli had the best changeup I've ever seen, righty lefty. And so now he's going to work with a guy who's got one that's as good as what he threw. So I wanted to circle back on him for a moment. With Iroh working with John, and John's getting his instructions from another former Baron, Matt Zaleski, who has taken over the pitching. Then a couple of guys that I know that are roving that are also like Kurt Hassler, who's coming down from the big league staff. And these guys are, again, teaching a combination of command and pitchability is a word that we like to use. And that's the thing that we've seen arms, Christian Mina, Matthew Thompson, the latest two that came through, great arms, guys, but command and pitchability wasn't yet there. It took them quite a long time, through the season.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that's really fun about Iriarte in particular is that he has the stuff, but you see the pitchability coming. It's not just a guy who's purely stuff, and he needs to figure out the command a little bit more, but you can see the way he sequences his pitches that the guy knows how to pitch, and he's got a lot in the tank and has more room to even grow still with on both sides of the pitching and the stuff. I think he still is a pretty lean guy. He could still add another few miles per hour, which is incredibly enticing considering he's already sitting 96 with his fastball. And then you talk about the command and the pitchability, right? He has a really good slider and the changeup that looked really good last year after he didn't throw it much the year before. So two really solid secondary offerings that he's still trying to figure out how to command. So there's a lot of room to see the growth from him. And I think the upside with Iriarte is as high, if not higher than Thorpe, but the way I see it. And then moving on to the last guy, someone that I'm not sure would reach Birmingham this year, still just 19 years old heading into the season, outfielder Samuel Zavala, who is a really good plate approach, known for kind of the on-base skills, athletic, playing center field, kind of just a really good athlete in general, needs to just grow, I think. I think with him, it's the exit velos are a little low, the contact rates are a little low, but he has a lot of room to grow, and he has a lot of upside from what we've seen so far. In terms of the hitting, what's hitting like in Birmingham, Kurt? Because I know there's definitely a reputation among that specific league about how pitching is generally more dominant. So what do you think about hitters kind of, especially a guy like him? If he reaches Birmingham probably later in the season, he'll only be 19 years old, maybe, 20 at Birmingham next year, hypothetically.
It's interesting. Going back, I always channeled the 2019 Barons and Gavin Sheets. And the White Sox told Sheets, you hit 8 to 10 home runs in Birmingham, that's like hitting 18 to 25 home runs in Winston or in Charlotte. Yep. And over the course of the last 4 or 5 years, interestingly enough, there's been a tremendous amount of construction around the ballpark, townhouses, apartment complexes, luxury buildings, where I think it has had a direct correlation between what's going on. So back in 19, when the area was still fairly new, it was absolutely a pitcher's ballpark. There's no doubt. We left Hoover Met, we went to Regions Field, and it was pitching, pitching, pitching. And now with all these buildings, the construction and the, it's either doing something to the wind or doing something affecting the last 2 years, and some of it has to do with the lack of pitching. The last 2 years, it has become a hitter's ballpark, and balls are starting to fly out of there that absolutely were not hit when we first opened that ballpark and for many years. So who would have thought, if Chris Getz and Jerry Reinsdorf and his people wanted to develop our pitchers, they would have bought all the buildings and the surrounding towers and put that in years ago. I'm somewhat of an expert. I've called every pitch at the new ballpark since 2013, and I've seen the evolution. So finally getting to the answer again, we went from a strictly pitcher's park now to a fairly decent pitcher's ballpark. And look, you hit it, it's going to go. And there's just streams that were not there when that park was built. Jeff, does that make any sense to you at all?
It makes perfect sense. We've got the same situation in Charlotte. Now, admittedly, it's a hitter's ballpark already, but a whole area around the ballpark has been developed. I mean, probably a half dozen or more high rises, and it's created wind tunnels that make the ball carry even more.
I feel a lot better now.
Yeah, that is super fascinating, Kurt. And this is one of the many reasons we have you on to talk about this, because that's something that most people, even just White Sox fans, would never know, because it's just something you notice over time being there and figuring it out, right? So it's exciting. This prospect return for Cease was something that's promising. I think it was slightly, I don't think it's an offer that, a deal that blew anybody away in terms of value, but three significant young pieces who are going to be part of the future of this team and all slot into, the top 10 in the organization, which is between last deadline and then this offseason and now this trade, right? Like, it's just a lot of pieces getting added to the system. And like you said, you throw a bunch of guys in there, some are going to hit. Not all of them are going to work out. There's going to be prospects that don't pan out, but a lot of these guys look really promising right now, and some of them are going to be serious big league pieces. So moving on to our next topic, Jeff, I'll start with you on this one. Garrett Crochet, opening day starter, has never started a game in the major leagues. I saw something on Twitter today that said the last start Crochet made was in 2019 against the Florida Gators as a Tennessee Volunteer. So pretty funny stuff, but he's been dominant all spring. He doesn't look anything like the version of himself last year that was struggling to get healthy. He looks healthy. He feels confident. He's not walking anybody, which is a huge difference for him as opposed to last year. The command is way better than we ever saw from him last season. So thoughts on Crochet being the opening day starter?
Well, no one saw this coming, right? Everyone assumed it was Eric Fetty, maybe Soroka because he was having such a good spring. But it's really exciting for White Sox fans. It gives you hope that Chris Getz and company are going to make the right decisions, because this is a beautiful call. I think it's the right move. Let's get Crochet in the rotation, see what he can do.
Yeah. Kurt, what do you think about it? I know you saw him a little.
Yeah. Do you imagine the courage that Chris Getz and the rest of his assistants to tell Michael Kopech, you are going to the bullpen, and to tell Crochet, you are going to be a starter? Now, we saw Crochet three times last year, Jeff, on rehabs. And the velocity was absolutely back, but there was just very, very little command. That big leg kick, which at the higher level, guys are going to be able to run, and the game's becoming that. I'm nothing short of shocked by that, to be opening day, no less, instead of let's stash him fifth.
Yeah.
One thing in our short briefings with Crochet is, and you two know this, he is a hell of a competitor. And so he's up to challenges. He's up to, hey, you want me to do this? I'll do this. He just wanted to be healthy. The Barons did not see, because he had three different rehabs, and every time he left us, he had to be shut down again. It was crazy. And so this is coming to me. This is coming not even left field. This is coming beyond left field.
Yeah, this is crazy. It really is not. It's unprecedented, honestly. It's not something that I think that the organization said from the beginning of the offseason, this is a guy that we want to be a starter eventually, which is great. That's exciting. I think that's something everybody was happy to hear. But in my mind, I heard that as we're going to stretch him out, have him be a long reliever, and we're going to eventually try to get him some starts mid-late season. That was kind of the way I interpreted that early in the offseason. And now here we are, and it's, March 18th, and he's making an opening day start in a week and a half. And that's just, I didn't see that coming. I don't think anybody saw that coming. And he's still not going to be a six-inning, seven-inning guy off the bat. I don't see any way that he throws more than, four innings on opening day. But that's, why not, right? If he's the best pitcher in the rotation right now, and he has been in spring training, give him 3-4 innings on opening day, and then you turn it to the bullpen and you see what happens. I mean, it's cool. I like it. I think it's creative. I think it's different. And I think he showed that he's ready to be in this role right now. I mean, 9 innings of no run ball with 12 strikeouts and not a single walk this spring. I mean, that's a guy who is dialed in. He's hitting his spots. He's working this cutter that has completely changed his arsenal. Having a cutter to play off of his slider is changing a lot of things because it's that same motion, but it's, you know, it's a different speed and it's a different spin to it, right? That's changed things for him because his fastball last year was flat at times, and now he's working this cutter in that just has a slightly different look, but it's working. So, you know, I think it's exciting, and I think we're looking forward to seeing what happens. And then from there, you know, if Fetty and Soroka seem like the locks behind him, right? I think they were already on track before Cease was traded to get the second and third starts. So I think that almost just makes it easier now to say, oh, those guys are the two and the three, because they were already on their schedule to be that before the Cease trade. So that, I think that's part of the reasoning in my mind that it went with Crochet, is because those guys were already kind of on schedule to be the second and third game starters. So now they don't have to adjust their schedule at all. They can stay on what they were, and Crochet can then fill in that first spot. So pretty interesting stuff. You know, we'll talk about a few guys soon that I also think should be in consideration for this rotation. But let's just start with, you know, Jeff, what do you got for Kurt? Just about the Barons and just about his life as a broadcaster for Birmingham.
Well, we certainly are looking forward to getting his thoughts on some of the guys that he saw last year who are some of the higher rated prospects, and also some under the radar guys. But before we do that, Kurt, I'd just like to know your background, how you got into this business, and how you ended up in Birmingham.
Well, Jeff, thanks for asking. And for Elijah and Jeff and the rest of the people that will watch this, I consider myself the Lou Gehrig of broadcasters. I've been quoted as been saying that, which means I'm the luckiest guy. I knew when I was 9 years old, growing up in New York, that's what I wanted to do. And growing up in New York, we have two sports teams for every sport. So you have Yankees and Mets, and you have Knicks and Nets, and Rangers and Islanders, and Jets and Giants. So you turn on TV 12 months out of the year, and you might not even like your hometown team, but there's another one usually 10 miles from there. So I think that was easy for me. It was an escape. And one of the guys that was a major, major influence over anybody in the New York, New Jersey area was Marv Albert. And at that time, you got to turn the dial back, at, you know, 30 some odd years. And Marv was there everywhere. Everywhere you looked up, Marv was doing a Knicks game, a Rangers game, boxing, the Jets, and he was the NBC sports, local sports anchor. So all that influence, Jeff, made it really easy for me. And again, I look around a room, I can go into a room of five people, a room of 500 people, and know that I'm probably the only one who really knew what they wanted to do. From there on in, just laying out a path and hope that it would lead eventually to the big leagues. And I went to school in North Carolina at UNC Greensboro. That was an adjustment from a New York kid going down to North Carolina. But the important thing was to get reps, get on the air, be involved as a freshman. And I was. And then from there, going to the winter meetings, which, guys, again, this, you know, put some age on me. Winter meetings used to be all about trades and about GMs getting together with big, long cigars and sitting in a room until 2 a.m. exchanging, all right, we'll give you three of these and you give me three of those guys. It's now more of a, maybe a free agent thing or more of a hand thing, and it lasts like 2 days. But going to the winter meetings is where I saw everybody in the industry. So I got my first job in Bakersfield, California, right up to the general manager. Hey, how you doing? I'd like to be a broadcaster, blah, blah, blah. Once you get in, it's basically you take a dart, you throw it, and hopefully it hits a target. And in my case, I say that people say, well, how'd you pick Birmingham? And I remind them, I didn't pick Birmingham. It picked me from Bakersfield to Woodbridge, Virginia, Huntsville, and then Birmingham. And it's just, you know, still like a player, trying to get up. And then 2 years ago, of course, I got that that one shot up there with the White Sox and the Guardians, which was a lot of fun. And that will always be for me. That's always still and will always be the dream. And there is, I think what I've learned along the way, because my hair used to look like Elijah, but you learn along the way to enjoy the journey a little bit. And I didn't know that when I was 25 years old. There was no enjoying the journey. It was get out of my way. I got to get to the big leagues.
All right. Well, that's a great story. And you know what? We wish you a lot of luck. Hope you reach where you aspire.
And again, you, yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, and you do excellent work. And that's something that I think a lot of fans can appreciate, because there's, in my opinion, there's still a lack of coverage for minor leagues in Major League Baseball in general, and just a lack of awareness of, you know, this is some of the best players in the world, not at the major league level, but some of the best exciting young people in the world playing, and incredibly talented broadcasters and crews and coaches and all of those aspects, right? So I really appreciate being able to watch a Birmingham Barons game and listen to you and listen to, you know, watching Charlotte and Birmingham and Winston and all these other teams. So we appreciate what you do, and I know a lot of fans feel the same way.
Thank you. And I have a responsibility. I think, Jeff, maybe you understand this, and Matt Swearhead does. You know, you have a responsibility every night. And what I tell the listeners at 7 o'clock Central, I said, for the next 3 hours, you relax and I'll do the work for you. You know, and that's no matter if there's one person, 100 people, or now that you have, you know, an app, they believe me, the moms and the girlfriends, they're all listening and they're watching, and you will hear about it if you mess the story up or mess up their name or something along those lines. So, you know, you have a responsibility to every single night at 7 o'clock Central, whether you're in, again, Charlotte's been as bad as Birmingham has been record wise. And you got to go in there going, tonight we're 0-0. Okay. 0-0. We got a chance to win this game. And, you know, lo and behold, one out of every 10, if it came out to be a 3-2 game that took 2 hours and 20 minutes, that's what got me in 36 plus years ago, and still keeping me in.
That's awesome. You know,
Kurt, I know this is going to be hard to believe. I used to have hair like Elijah too.
Yeah.
But so tell us what a typical day is like for you during the season. Do you go to batting practice a lot? Do you interact with the players, the coaches? What's a typical day?
Baseball guys, baseball is like no other sport in terms of the prep, because we play it every day. And here's the way I give a shorter version of that answer is, if I'm at the ballpark 1 minute later than 2 o'clock, then I'm late. And that's for a 7 o'clock game. And even my mom asks me, and my fan, why do you got to go so early? What are you doing there? And if I took a camera with me and someone watched me, you'd be amazed how quickly 2 o'clock becomes 3 o'clock, 3 o'clock becomes five becomes six becomes your meal, your pregame, and all that. So anyways, the first thing we always look for, always, both sides, are lineups. You can't do anything without lineups. You have to have your working card, your scorecard, with lineups. And in my case, for 36 years prior, I fill out not only the starting nine and the starting pitcher, but the entire bullpen and the entire bench. I want to know what my manager's got available. And I think it's important for my viewers, now they're no longer listeners, but the viewers, to know we got one lefty and one switch hitter on the bench. And I don't want to be guessing. You know, I want to know right down there. So filling out that scorecard properly takes quite a long time, with the notes that you'll put there. And again, you remembering that we play every day. So you go from, you know, 1-for-3, and then now all of a sudden he's 2-for-6 in the series, and he's 4-for-12 against that certain team. I try, and I will say that I'm not the best at this, but I will try to get down on the field a few minutes for both. But you have to remember, guys, is that we're in a special industry. We're in the entertainment business, and you have to enjoy. And again, that's something I have to reteach myself, is to stop the preparation, just screeching brakes, halt, like a cartoon character, go down and just feel BP. Okay. Manager, a couple of, you know, minutes with him. I used to spend a lot of time in the bullpen. I wanted to see our pitchers. I wanted to talk to our pitching coaches. I really enjoyed those days. And being around the league so long now, I think it's also important. I try to introduce myself to the visiting manager, his staff, and, you know, get to know their players. And because of the way the broadcast is, if the visiting team wins, I'll have those guys up on my postgame show live. And so we've had All-Stars and MVPs and Rookie of the Years and all that over the last several years come up and do post-game show. So anyways, you got you're downstairs for a little bit. You go back up to the scorecard. There's definite, look, we all got to eat. You got a budget. And I try to eat as early as possible. For me, in my day, that's somewhere around, it depends on the food, sir, but maybe around 5:15, you're wolfing and golf and just throwing it down. You absolutely, and that could be the time where I'm spending with the visiting radio guy. Tell me about your team. Let's go over pronunciations. Who's hot? Who's not? Why do you have so many wins? Why do you have so many losses? That's your time right there. He is going to be doing the opposite of what I'm doing, which means when I'm ready to go up to the booth, he's going downstairs as the visiting guy to talk with his team. And I always look, again, we play every day. I look for stories. I look for, he was a teammate of so-and-so at college. When we had Hackenberg. So I researched the four Hackenberg brothers and talked to Adam about that and, you know, wanted to know what they're currently doing and things like that. Before you know it, you're upstairs, back upstairs in the 6 o'clock. I want to be near my equipment around 6 o'clock. And because, guys, you can ask any broadcaster in the world, there's always distractions. And you might have had a late roster move. You might have had manager calls up. You build your relationship. He calls up and goes, we've got a lineup change. And they get to start everything all over again. There's that time where I'm just thinking off the top of my head when scouts come in. And before the pandemic, scouts was part of what we do. I mean, their conversation coming into my radio booth and feeling comfortable asking me questions and this, that, the pandemic hits, and then they kind of slowed down. But last year we saw, and it was, you know, it made sense because the White Sox had a lot of pieces at that big league level that other teams wanted. So scouts would come in, and I think that's important. Jeff, so much of what I say, I need a scout who's trained, who can tell me what I'm seeing. Okay. You know, Elijah was there and he saw that as well. And I want to make sure that what's coming out of my mouth, what I'm seeing is confirmed with what they're scouting and what they're charting and telling me, you know, a 270 hitter playing shortstop. And there was a guy with the Tennessee Smokies last year, a shortstop, a 260, 270 hitter. And I didn't think the first day or two, he wasn't a high prospect, but I didn't think a day or two. And then he said, look at his hands, watch him. He will play in the big leagues. And that's the kind of invaluable information. We go on at quarter of, so 6:45, the music hits, and I am in an absolute zone. I am pumped. I'm ready to go. I've been blessed. You do the math. I can't. 36 years of 140 games, and I know that when I the first thing that comes out of my mouth is, you know, good evening and welcome to the Magic City of Birmingham, Alabama. I want boom right there, right in the face, and I want somebody to relax, sit back, and let me do the work for the next 3 hours, and hopefully not only entertain but educate, and you know, hopefully mix in a competitive game. I'll just leave it at that.
For those listening, first of all of that great, awesome insight. It's really cool to just hear. For those curious, that's over 5,000 AA baseball games that Kurt has called in his career with the Barons. I just did a little bit of math. That's pretty incredible, honestly, that is. And I think that's just awesome to hear all of your takeaways and just everything that you go through, whether it be the other team and the detail you put into your work, because it shows. And it's cool to hear from the outside perspective the amount of time that goes in with between scouts and the other team and your own team and all the different things to just make sure that you have every piece of information you need. Jeff, I'll let you.
Well, why don't we switch gears and talk about some players. Elijah, I know there are a lot of guys that you want to get into further.
Yeah, let's do it. We'll start with this one, because this is a guy me and Jeff have talked about a lot, and we just mentioned it earlier. What did you see from Nestrini last year? He came over to the Sox and made, you know, I think he only made four or five starts with Birmingham. What were some of the factors with him that you see being, you know, a big league pitcher? Because I believe he should be in the rotation for the White Sox today. I think he's proven in training that he's ready to be in the rotation, especially after the Cease trade. If not, he'll be in Charlotte to start the season. But Nestrini looks to be pretty dang close to being a White Sox start. What did you see in the very, I know very limited time you got to see him, but what were some of the qualities that you stood out from him?
First thing is maturity, and that is both on the mound and in the radio booth. Somebody who is, you know, well-rounded, was very appreciative of what the Dodgers had built, that base that they built for him. And he mentioned that on the post-game show. He said, look, you know, I wouldn't be here without them taking what I've got. And then he's gifted with one of the nastiest sliders that you, some think you can teach, some think you can't, but with our arm and then a slider as well, this was definitely an upper level pitcher. You know what I'm saying? I mean, this is not a guy that needs to be hanging around at the lower levels. So he had he had everything. He wasn't ranked, so you know, whatever that means, by pipeline as high as others at time of the trade, which is scary to see what else the Dodgers have, but an excellent haul, an excellent ask. And we go back again to the scouts, and it's the scouts who gave the input to Chris and his staff and said, you know, because I know how I know now how it works. And basically a farm director, GM, will say, we got a chance to make a trade for X, and we got two guys off of this roster. Here's the four names. Give me two of the four. Okay. So Chris Getz himself might not know that he's getting Nick Nastrini, but the scout who saw him in the Texas League turns it in and says, we got to get this guy. You know, and that's where you rely on other eyes and input of others. And so I think that part of it is very, very fascinating. But there's a maturity about Nick right out of the gate. Boom, just like that. You just knew he was well-rounded individual.
That's the exact thing I noticed talking to him in Birmingham, and I've gotten to know him well. I had him on the podcast. I talked to him in Arizona this year. He's super mature. He knows what he's doing, and he carries himself in a way that is just professional. And he's there to play, but he's also there to talk and to be open and to analyze himself and to think through what he's doing. He's very cerebral with the way he thinks through pitching, which I can appreciate, because that's it matters, right? Like there's more to pitching than just being able to have the stuff. And he has the stuff, of course, but he thinks about it, and he thinks about his pitching, and he considers his sequencing, and he knows how to just play his stuff off itself and trust that he is a good pitcher, and then use his brain to execute at the best of his abilities. Switching gears over to another guy, another pitcher that I think, you know, not quite as ready per se as Nick, but someone who I think is going to have a shot to debut with the White Sox this year. Jonathan Cannon made his way up to Birmingham after being in Winston for most of the year. He wasn't great in his time in Birmingham, but he showed me a lot of things in Birmingham, even though he struggled at times, that gave me kind of a sense of confidence in him moving forward. What about him and kind of his arsenal, and then just the way that he approaches pitching in general?
Similar to Nestrini in terms of the maturity, Cannon's also a big guy who pitched at an elite conference at Georgia with SEC. And so you know that for 3 years, he faced great competition. The White Sox, the last 2 years, absolutely pushed and rushed some, I'm hesitant to say players, certainly some pitchers like Cannon, who a few years ago would not have even sniffed Birmingham. And again, I'm not a farm director, so I can't tell you what's best, what's worse. He did not put up the numbers. He was also in the futures game. And he was not putting up those kind of numbers. You could see arm strength, and he did have that one game, not looking at the game, but he had one really, really solid game. What he's got to do, and I think Nastrini is a little bit ahead of him. Cannon's got to, first of all, get a third pitch and also command and last a little longer, okay? And that's one thing about Nastrini. I think Nick could easily give you six, seven innings without hesitation because he can get you out on the slider. He can get you out on contact, whatever. And Cannon's going to be more of a high ball pitcher. And it's, again, you look at our charts, four and a third, four and two thirds, five and a third, five and a third, five, in order to get to the big leagues and go higher and further, you've got to be throwing six innings up there every time out. And getting deep into games. Just listen to the great pitchers in the big leagues, and that's their number one goal, getting deep into a game and taking a jiff, because we haven't had anything in this system resembling a bullpen. You turn it over and it's not pretty, unfortunately. And so the deeper Cannon can go, the less outs you have to get at the end.
What do you see as his ETA? You think he needs another year in Birmingham and then half a year in Charlotte?
You need an answer. And so what I think and what the new farm director thinks are two different things. I would start him in Birmingham. I would give him 5 to 7 starts, absolutely. And I would want him to dominate. And then if he does, and the numbers, don't worry about the numbers, though, but just go out there, go deeper into games, have that dominant outing. You can't control what the other team or if your team is scoring, I should say. And then I would get him up to AAA and then keep him there the rest of the year because he's got to face elite hitting. He's got to face guys that are going to want to wear him down and wear him out. So answering the question, that would be sometime in 25. My time frame doesn't match what the White Sox are doing, yeah. But I don't think it's at 24. He's got to really take a major leap.
Yeah, and it's interesting you say that. One thing I talked to him in Arizona a few weeks ago. He's kind of, so I'm sure you've noticed this. He's a guy who kind of messed around with like 6-7 pitches, right? He was trying to figure out last year a lot of what his pitches are. And this year he was telling me this spring, he's only throwing 4 pitches. He's got it down to 4. He likes his 4 and he's really focused on kind of honing in on how to command those 4 to the best of his abilities rather than trying to mix in 6 different offerings and see what happens, right? Which is really cool to see in my opinion, because I always thought last year, it's nice to have a lot of options, but it's really good to have some you feel confident in. And he was telling me, his sweeper that he kind of just started throwing last year, really, it didn't used to be an offering for him, has become a big thing for him. And that's his strikeout pitch now. And then he has his cutter and his sinker that are kind of playing off of each other in different ways now with a changeup mixed in there as well. So I like the way that he's approaching things. He sounds like he has an even more refined mindset right now. And that's going to be, like you said, there's more work to be done there, but I think he has the makings of a guy who can be, at the very least, a solid big league arm, which is exciting. So, Jeff, do you have any other pitchers? I'm trying to think. I have one more, but I want to see if you have any other pitchers.
Well, I'd like to talk about two other new guys, Jake Eater and Bush, and see, get your thoughts on those guys.
Yeah. It's funny because they are a tag team, aren't they? they yeah. One, you have to say the other.
Right.
And it's remarkable, guys, because I've seen them at their peak in the minor leagues and I've seen them at their worst. And that's what happens. And your casual fan, maybe not so much for this podcast because they know a heck of a lot more. That's not a casual. But I can tell you this. When the White Sox got Eater for Berger, there was a major outcry. How the heck could you give up Berger? He was hitting home runs and he was the face of that franchise and blah, 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 blah. Well, 90% of those people never saw what Jake Eater did 2 years ago when he was healthy and he was called the best pitcher in the minor leagues. All right. With Eater and Bush last year, their paths were identical. It was a mirror. So they both start the season hurt. They both didn't throw on the mound until about mid-June of last year. They both get started with their original organizations. Okay, all right, we're going along and I haven't pitched in a half a year, so I'm a little bit rusty. Gone. Just when you got comfortable, traded and gone. In the case of Bush, he faced the team that he just got traded for. Okay, the Angels are in our league, obviously. And Carroll and Bush were like a day later facing their teammates. And guys, we have to, and I hope that people that are watching this and will replay it, they'll understand. And I use this analogy a lot on the air. Imagine whatever you guys do and whatever anybody else is doing. And then someone taps you on the shoulder. Maybe you're a mechanic. Maybe you own the finest restaurant. But in this case, you're a baseball pitcher or a player and pitcher. And they say, you're traded. You're gone. Put down the knife and the fork if you're a chef. Put down your wrenches and your hydraulics if you're a mechanic. Put down your pens and paint and paper if you're an accountant. And you have now, you'll be doing that for the competition, not for us anymore. We're done. That first trade is always the toughest, always, because every guy I've ever talked to feels that this is the organization that took the chance and is going to get them to the big leagues. So we had two pitchers who 2 years ago were near the top of minor league baseball. Eater was on the cusp and called by many the best pitcher in the minor leagues. Bush, big, strong kid, with an intimidation factor because of his size and his smarts, and was dominating in Mobile. They both get hurt. They both miss a tremendous amount of time. They both get on the mound. They both got traded, and they both really, really struggled. And I know why. And because of the things we just talked about. And it was difficult. And if you are a White Sox, again, fan, you're following the team, and you're looking at Bush and Eater and going, this is what we got for Berger, and this is what we got, the Angels trade over there. But what they didn't know, again, was all that stuff that I just mentioned. So I am really, really looking forward. You can give me 100 more names, but the two that I focus on for me is Bush and Eater. And did the White Sox get what I think they got? They didn't get the return, Jeff and Elijah. They didn't get the return right away. And as fans, when you're invested, you want the immediate return. I got to have it now. I want to read that Eater was 5-0 with the Barons and was dominating. Far from it. Both of them. Yeah. Far from it. I'm not even looking at their ERAs, but they were plus six, both of them.
Yeah. You just said everything that I've wanted to say and I've said parts of over the last, 6 months and 8 months since that trade, because I got to clip what you just said, honestly, and get it out there, because that's the reality, right? I think people are very quick to forget. I've said this to Jeff many times. People are very quick to forget that these players are human beings. And that's something that we at Future Sox try to emphasize. And I take a personal kind of mission in emphasizing that, because there's a lot more that goes into baseball than on the field. And I'm really sick and tired of people just saying that both those guys are busts and they don't matter, like you just said, because there's a ton of talent in the tank. And I am completely with you. Those are two of the guys I'm the most excited to see in this whole farm system this season, because there's a lot of talent there. They've showed it in the past. They're healthy now. They're used to their organization. And I'm really, really looking forward to seeing both those guys throw this year. So I'm glad you're on the same page there. That's awesome to hear. Shifting gears over to the offensive side of the ball. This guy is obviously, I think you've expected this one to talk about him a little bit. So, Colson Montgomery is one of the best prospects in baseball. That's become pretty apparent after the AFL, after last season. Last year was shaky for him, though. I think he's been very adamant about the fact that, like, last year was not the best for him, right? He had an injury. He was sick at one point in the season. He was kind of just trying to find his groove, and it took him really till later in the season in Birmingham to really get in his rhythm. But when he's on the field, the guy's got the approach of a seasoned veteran. He's got, the pure bat talent of almost any player in the minors, right? And it almost feels like he still hasn't even reached what we know he can be, because the power is still kind of, he's growing into it. He's still finding kind of his impact at the plate beyond just an approach that's really good. So Montgomery is someone that everyone sees, obviously, as having a ton of upside. But what are some things you can tell us about him from what you've seen that might not be, the common knowledge of him as a prospect?
I wish that he wasn't labeled as, you know, the next, not Cal Ripken, but
Corey Seager.
Corey Seager.
Yeah.
These labels, guys, are huge for a teenager, a 20-year-old. And you absolutely, I don't care what they tell me, because my eyes are going to tell me more. You go into that box, in that batter's box, and you're starting to think, well, everyone tells me I'm the sixth best prospect in all of baseball, and I better hit this one over the batting cage in right field, or else it's a failure at bat. And one at bat leads to the next. As a scout told me, remove first round off of Montgomery. Just remove that label, first round, and then look at what you have. And you have a talented high schooler who has plus offensive approach and plus offensive potential, which is why you draft somebody, because of their potential. I don't want to play farm director again. I wonder at some point if I look up and we see him at third base, because we started doing that with Jose Rodriguez and Lenin Sosa, guys who were advanced offensively, and they were big league guys. They would eventually get a taste of the leagues. Think again with that pressure that Montgomery has, is now playing it short, there's nowhere to hide. And so the expectations, and every time he makes a play, Corey Seager, you look at the size, he's left-handed like Seager, and he would be best left alone if you didn't know what was there, in terms of the dual athleticism. There's a wonderful basketball player, as we all know, but I know, because I've spent now quite some time with him, and Colson will not, he's not going to tell you I'm tired. He's not going to say the pressure or this, that, and the other. He's going to try to give you the coach speak answer of like, hey, I'm in the box, I'm battling, I'm grinding, I'm doing whatever I can, but I can watch the walk from the dugout to the batter's box. And it's the longest walk, Jeff, that there might be in pro sports, because what goes through the mind is 4,000 different things. From the time you leave that dugout to the batting on deck circle to the box, you've already changed your approach in your mind a lot. And that's a lot for, what is Colson now, 20?
22.
Okay, 22. And has not even come close to playing a full season. Yep. Not even come close. He's been hurt and dinged up every year. And so this is the year. What I would look at is try not to look at the overall numbers until the season is done. But more important, what I would look is games played. And, we play 138 in the minor leagues. And if he can get to 110, 105, something like that, he just needs that in every way.
Yeah,
unfortunately, that pressure is not going to change. But I will say one thing about Colson. He's got the swagger, the confidence to handle it as well as anybody, I think.
Yeah, and one thing I loved hearing from him is in spring training, he told me, this year, he was like, last year I was a little overwhelmed. He did admit that, actually. So I know you say he is really confident and he carries himself with the confidence, but he's able to see that, he's growing. I think you can see that he is mentally just getting more used to it and understanding the pressure better, because it is a lot of pressure. Right? But I can see even in the last 2 years, he has started to learn more and more about how to handle that, as opposed to, fold under it. Right. So he carries himself high and he has that pressure on himself, but I also think he's ready. And I think he's confident in himself and knows that he can do what he wants to do. Right. It is about games. I completely agree. You got to get him healthy. And that's why the idea that some have thrown out there of him being, immediately on the roster or in the next first 2 months of the season, 3 months of the season. I'm very against that. I just don't, it's not that I don't think he's talented enough, because I think he could go up to the big leagues and be at least a serviceable player. But I think I want to see at least 3 to 4 months of him getting everyday reps in the minor leagues just to get himself physically and mentally ready for the everyday grind of being a Major League Baseball player, because it's going to get more and more hard as he gets older, right? So I think, I still think most people think he's going to get called up eventually this season, but I'm hoping it's more of a late season, you know, mid to late at least, as opposed to any time in the first few months, because I do agree that he needs more of that everyday, you know, in and out reps just to be ready to play. So shifting over to one of the other guys, another guy who started the season hurt last year, also has a lot of pressure on him, you know, not quite as much as Colson, right? But probably the second most, you know, well-known, well-regarded offensive prospect was Brian Ramos, who you got to see a little in 2022. And then again, for most of last season, once he came back from his injury, what about Ramos? You know, I love his energy. I just think he has a presence to him that is pretty awesome. So what about Ramos and his game particularly? Do you see kind of getting him to the next level this coming year?
I love everything about him. I think he's every much the prospect offensively as everybody and anybody else we have in the system. Each at bat, the way he attacks, the power that he has, the opposite way, he's a right-handed hitter, as you know, the approach. And here's a guy who a few years ago couldn't speak one word of English. He's from Cuba. And now can handle any interview in English. Now he'll feel a little bit more comfortable in Spanish, but he will talk with you. He will greet you. He will smile. He will go, he can, and it will be rare, but maybe an 0-for-4 with 3 strikeouts. But the very next day he's on the field with a smile that big. He just loves to play. And that's the bottom line. And is very evident, you know, he had that core muscle injury that just threw off his whole season. But once he got locked in, and that took a while because it June for him was April and March for everybody else. But once he got locked in again, he's one of those rare guys who owned the at-bat. And he was going to punish the pitcher's mistakes. And a lot of fun to watch. And I think it's important to talk about how his defense is terrific, and it did not have any issues, no problems, nothing at all. Along with, you know, people haven't talked about his defense. That was surprising. Maybe he's gotten better. I don't know what he was, but I know what he is. And and he played a heck of a third base last year. He was overshadowed by Tampa's guy, Candelario, and. You know, Caminero, thank you. And, yeah. Ramos was, you know, similar in a sense, but Caminero was elite. But Ramos was not far behind. I think that's the easy way to put it, that he could look and go, oh, you know what? I see him out there. You know, where is he?
Right. I think that's great. You mentioned the defense too, because I think whether they would say this or not, I think part of why Colson hasn't been tested anywhere else is because you've got Ramos at third. I think that's part of it. And I don't think the organization would say that directly, but it's hard to argue with what Ramos has done. And Colson definitely has a more well-rounded package, but Ramos has been really good at third and he's gotten a lot better. I do know that for a fact, because I watched him when he was playing in Winston the year before, and he was good at third, but he still had some shakiness with his hands. His footwork was a little bit sloppy at times when he was first coming up. He's clean, man. I mean, he really knows how to approach the ball. He has good range at third base. He's athletic. The arm strength is there. You know, his throws, I think his throwing accuracy still is going to keep getting a little bit better as he ages. I think he has a tendency to loft some throws at times. But the footwork and the handwork and just his strength and athleticism at third base is very apparent. It's not just a guy who, you know, I think when he was first getting really ranked in among the prospects of the White Sox a year or two, 2 years ago, right? He was looked at as kind of he'll be okay at third. Right now, it's like, this is an above average everyday third baseman. Like, it's not just, oh, he can play some third. Like, he's a good third baseman with tons of upside at the bat and 20 plus home runs, you know, potential if things click.
Well, the strength of him defensively is the ball that the weak two hopper, three hoppers that's hit in front, and he's got to get charge it and throw off balance. And just did an unbelievable job, saved a lot of anguish and a lot of runs that we already were giving up. But Guys, here's the thing about Ramos, and I want our viewers to understand this. This is what made him special, and this is why I knew Eloy and Luis Robert were special guys as well. And this is what makes Ramos special. The Barons had an awful record, an awful ERA, and as Charlotte did, and it was really a down year in the system. We know that it's been a down 2 years, but he comes up in a 10-0 game. We're down. Barons is down 10-0. It's bottom of the ninth. I'm telling you, everybody is home, and Ramos is digging in there, and he hits a home run. And he did that a couple of times. That's something that White Sox fans and viewers of this podcast and this, you can't teach. Again, that's a guy who loves to play, and that's a guy that's going to be on my team. He's down 10-0, and he's fighting off to be, you know, what's it going to do if he hits it out to over the center field wall? It's not going to make a difference in the game. But he had battled that at bat. Next thing you know, instead of a 10-0 shutout, it's 10-1 because of what he did. And he did that many, many times. There's an old saying we always use. It's giving away at bats. And he will never give away an at bat. You know, just that's again, something that cannot be taught.
That's an incredible thing to hear. Jeff, I've got one more player, but I want to give it to you before we got to wrap here soon. This has been a ton of good insight, Kurt. But you got anybody else, Jeff, before I do my one more?
Well, quickly, I wanted to circle back on two guys you just mentioned, Jose Rodriguez and Lenin Sosa. Were you surprised about the lack of results as they moved forward?
Well, again, we're the Sox, we have been there 33 years. God, they needed to try something. The big leagues were getting no results and you know, bringing in name guys to hold down a position. But anybody, Sosa and Rodriguez, they need consistent at-bats. And they're not going to get it in the big leagues, and that's the hard part. That's where they want to be. And I've never met a guy that said, you know what, I'd rather get 450 at-bats in Charlotte than to get one at bat every 30 days in Chicago. No, they take that one out of every 30 days. But for them to reach their potential, and Jose Rodriguez is a special ball player, offensively and defensively, special. But he cannot be successful. He went up to the big leagues. It was, I believe it was 8 days. He got in as a pinch runner, and that was it. So you can't, it's so hard to judge. What Sosa did again, now remember, Sosa carried that double-A success to triple-A. He absolutely did. Okay. But they were hesitant to put him in at second base every day, which, you know, we're down here, the minors going, hand it to him, give him 350, 400 bats, let's measure and see what we got. So to answer your question, surprised by it? No, because there's nobody. And again, I say this just like one of the other analogies. Imagine whatever you do and then now do it only twice a week. Okay. I couldn't be that good of a broadcaster if my only job, you know, twice a week broadcasting.
Right.
In my case, you know, for most of those 36 previous years, it's 140 games. So I'm bound to improve. So Sosa and Popeye Rodriguez, I get him confused with the other. There's a Yolbert Sanchez too, not to be confused with Yolbert, but with Popeye Rodriguez and Lenin, they're going to have to get 450, 500 bats before I measure them.
Right.
And what they do is they also provide, right now at the AAA level, they will provide some depth that will allow, and I don't know where Colson's going. I'm looking at a preliminary roster, and it's too early, but, and this, the roster I got was before the Padres trade.
Right.
So everybody we talked about, give me a 500 at bat season for all of them. I'll throw two names out there because you always want to hear other, hey, tell me, Duke Ellis and Terrell Tatum. You know, fairly profile names in this system. If you talk about the White Sox, you know, they were hurt. And in Duke's case, I think he played like 10 games, if that. And this is one of the fastest guys in minor league baseball. Tremendous speed, center field play, could bunt, run, do this, that, and the other. Played 10 games. So until, you know, any of those guys we mentioned, got to get 500. Yeah. A pitcher needs, in my estimation, 10 to 15 starts before we start measuring. Now you've got something that you can go by.
Right. I've got one more guy, and we got to finish up, as much as I would sit here and talk to you for like 3 hours, Kurt. But Wilfred Varas is the last guy I want to talk about, because it's rare to see a guy go to Double A and get better. And that's a guy who was good in Winston, but then was amazing in Birmingham, which is really not something you see often. And I think defensively, there's a lot of questions around him. But what do you see just offensively with Varas that made him so successful in Birmingham?
Elijah, you got to remember, he came up for Project Birmingham.
I know.
So we got our first look at that time. I think he was 19. He's
19, yeah.
The dude can hit.
Yeah.
Rolls out of bed. He's getting a base hit. Okay. So he didn't make the Barons out of spring training, came up second half of last year, and he's just a hit machine, man. An absolute mature, incredible approach, fearless, works the pitcher. And this is one guy where during Project Birmingham, we had to hide him because he doesn't have a place to play defensively. But last year was adequate. And did not hurt himself in either left or right field. Made tremendous amount of strides. It's an elite bat that can't be taught. I don't know where it eventually fits, and neither do the White Sox, because he's played like four or five different positions. But you've got a guy and punish this league at a young age. Put him in the outfield, and like I said, he held his own last year.
I completely agree with you on all of that. I think he's going to find a role. I think the corner outfields are going to be the spot for him personally. And even if he ends up being kind of a DH outfield combo, right? Like the bat can play, and he just got to reduce his chase a little bit. And there's a lot to like there. Kurt, thank you so much for coming on. This was incredible. Everybody go check out Kurt on Twitter, KurtBloom4. And then beyond that, you know, Birmingham Barons games. If you want to watch some of the future stars of the White Sox, there is no better broadcaster to listen to than Kurt and team to watch right now than the Barons. There's going to be a ton of talent there all season.
Let me get a promo in there.
Get a promo.
Yeah, Friday. And it will be Friday, April 5th.
April 5th.
It'll be the Barons and the Chattanooga Lookouts.
Everybody, make sure to tune in. Kurt, thank you so much. This was another episode of the Future Sox Roundup, and we will talk to you all next week.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
For sure.